deeper down the rabbit hole. Saturday, 6 p.m., live in Toronto, Ontario, at the Queen City Curio, a cult and spiritual store. Welcome, this is Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole, or the Queen City Curio videocast, depending on which media you are finding this at. 6 years now, right, Zach? 6 years of podcasts of various occult, pagan, interesting authors, or social topics. 6 years of backlog that we can go through. And now, you know what? Now we're always broadcasting live from where, Zach?
607 Girard Street East, Toronto, Ontario, East Chinatown. That's right. The Queen City Curio and Apothecary.
So in case people are wondering, today we have a tarot expert on. We have her book. It's right here, Holistic Tarot. Oh, my God. You can't see this.
You can't see it.
You can't see how thick this is, but let me put my iPhone right here so you can see.
It's thick.
It's right there. Right? This is how much information in the book. It's an awesome, awesome book. Goes through everything you could want to, not everything, but a lot of what you could know about the various correspondences with the tarot and how to approach it. We're happy to have Benabel here today to talk about this, kind of this tone. But, you know, it's been a couple years, so we'll give her some forgiveness if she can't exactly match the page. But she's one of the experts on tarot across the board, with one of the best written books we've seen for how thorough it is on the Rider White deck. And not only that, she's a lawyer.
Yep.
It doesn't get better than that. So, again, focusing on like the fact that, just to kind of point out to people, there's a lot of us in the spiritual field that have professional degrees.
Yes,
I think that's
do.
Kind of a point. Yeah, kind of an important point to point out, because everyone kind of has this idea of who gets into this. And yet, that's not what's going on today. To start us off, like, how did you get into this? Because we were talking before the show about how you rejected and rebelled against Buddhism and Taoism and came to the tarot. So how did that come about?
Well, I grew up in a family that was very steeped in, at the time, I never saw it as superstition. It was just so interwoven into everyday life. So it was sort of assumed that the spirits of our, you know, ancestors, aunts, uncles, past grandparents were all around. They talked about immortals and gods and goddesses, bodhisattvas, as if they were real. There was this syncretization of Buddhism and Taoism, so I couldn't even really discern the difference until much later in college, when I started to get into a more academic interest in Buddhism and Taoism. So the actual sort of practice of it was very much interwoven. And so I think when I started, you know, school as this young child in upstate New York suburbia, all white town, I had a lot of sort of dissonance between trying to figure out how to, you know, behave and how to comport myself, what you can say to people in school among white kids, and what my parents treated and took as gospel, took as truth, and what I was growing up as truth, like, you know, being a psychic, dream working. And I use the word shamanism carefully because it's not really shamanism, but I just can't think of a better word in terms of translations, right? Just this concept of going into an altered state of consciousness to seek a divine form or incorporeal form of consult. And that was something I grew up with. So then when I get into school and you're trying really hard to be accepted and to be liked and to be popular, I knew I had to reject that. And so I tried very hard to reject anything that was from that culture, anything that was superstitious, and try to find something that made me assimilate better into the society that was in. But then I think at the heart of it, you're born the way you are. So you're still interested in the occult. You still have interest in what's beyond the veil. And so I just got into the tarot thinking the tarot had absolutely nothing to do with the occult, which is a weird thing to think. But, you know, that was kind of where I was coming from, just an immature little kid. And so I got into the tarot. I got into different forms of Western divination, fortune telling. I was reading Eliphas Levy. So that was where my interest was. And it really wasn't until my college years I began to integrate the two, returned to more Eastern forms of spirituality and just getting back into my roots. So now I do a more of a middle path where I syncretize Eastern and Western occultism. But that's how I got into the tarot. It was the rejection of my culture. sadly enough.
It's all good. It's all good.
So you actually had this story about, initially, kind of in the book, about picking up a plane back that had the journey to the West. And then kind of pick up vibes from that while you're just kind of starting to get into the tarot.
I still have it. I actually found the deck much later on, and I scanned it in and put it on my website to see, for people to see. But yeah, it had all the characters of, what's Shioji? Journey to the West, right?
Journey to the West, yes.
I never know how to translate things. But yeah, so Journey to the West, I had the characters on there, and it was just a mythology or story I just loved as a child. I knew all the stories, right? And so when you see it on a deck of playing cards, you would string together different cards, you draw them at random, and I would just tell myself these stories based on what was coming out of the spread. And that was, weirdly enough, a form of oracle or tarot divination. And when I found tarot itself, I think it was just a very easy and, you know, comfortable segue into that.
And still being able to reject it.
I think that's the thing, though. Being human means you're hypocritical, right? Like, you think you know what you're doing. Being a hypocrite is very human.
I am not bound by the demon of consistency. Are you, any of you, bound by the demon of consistency?
Nope.
Would like to be.
So a lot of the examples you have in the book uniquely deal with business and personal development in a business setting, which is kind of interesting. It's not geared necessarily to people. It is geared to people interested in sort of spiritual development, but there's a much closer tone to using this in business development and personal development in how it applies to your professional life. And maybe you could talk about, because I think this is one of the aspects of tarot that maybe people don't get, or they think it's not true, but maybe you could give us some examples in your life, how you actually use this for real financial success, how you translated the tarot into either developing new skills that were appropriate at the right time, or how you personally used it to really kind of get business and personal success in a way that maybe other people don't talk about. Because I thought a lot of the undercurrent on this was how to be successful in life, not necessarily how to be successful in tarot cards or reading tarot cards. That's there too, but
I think it's interwoven, though, right? I think if you know how to use the tarot to succeed in life, then implicit in that is that you've mastered the tarot. Because how can you use tarot to be successful if you don't know tarot? So I think the highest and most advanced level of tarot knowledge is to actually be able to implement that knowledge in a way that's extremely productive. And so I think that was why that was my mission statement, was to talk about, okay, well, you're a great tarot reader. That's wonderful and all, but what's the purpose? At the end of the day, what does that bring to your life? What does that bring to the well-being of your loved ones and your friends? And so I always want to find a purpose for something. Like, what is the productivity of this thing that's in my life? And so for me, tarot really did have that. And that's why it's proved to be a lasting part of my life. A less serious example of how it does, like, my husband is a financial analyst. And so I've used the tarot to help him, you know, pick his stocks. And we've played around with that a lot, where, you know, he was talking to his friends about how, you know, sometimes it's so volatile, the market, that it's like a monkey throwing a dart at the board and figuring out what stocks to buy. So I said, well, what about a witch throwing cards on the table? Who's better, right? And so we decided to play games where he would go about it the real financial analyst way, and I, who know nothing about it, would use tarot cards to pick between different stocks. And we found that it worked quite well. And so that's some way I use tarot as well. And I just think that it's important to find a purpose for it, you know?
Now, did it work better with the financial analysts being able to give you equal choices? Did that come to be the best of all worlds between the tarot and the analysis? Or just the witch was just straight up better? Or which one? Like, you know,
what's the stats?
Yeah, you know.
Both, and depending on what. So I actually found when you're getting into markets of innovation, like really at the cunning, you know, at the cusp of research, when it's really, it could go either way. Even a seasoned financial analyst wouldn't be able to predict what would happen, because you're talking about markets of innovation. I actually think that the witch can do better, because they have this intuition that is that they're exercising a muscle that I think if you're too stuck in a logical minded approach to life, you don't exercise that muscle. So you can't foresee certain things. You're too stuck in your way of thinking. But the witch who doesn't think your way, doesn't have your form of academic or formal training, can think differently, think outside the box, to use a cliche. So they're better at predicting those areas. But I think obviously you can't say that she's going to be better at stocks than the person who's studied it, right?
You might be. Well, it depends on how much background knowledge you actually pick up from your husband.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm.
Because we know from statistics, like, you know, if you get enough information, then you're applying the intuition in a background way.
Exactly.
So if he's dropping enough hints about which potential stocks, he's already limited the playing field, making a divination much easier for you. Like, it's like subconscious knowledge almost. Like, he's pushed it into the computer of intuition that is you, or the witch that is an intuition of you. And then basically what comes out is there's a lot less choices.
Yeah, and I actually think that's valid. That's a valid way to utilize intuition or divination systems, because I think it's almost like an excuse or permission slip to activate subconscious knowledge, that if you didn't have this platform or medium, you might be more resistant to leaning into your subconscious knowledge. So even when people say that as a way to dispel, you know, or to disprove, when skeptics use that to disprove tarot, I'm like, I don't think it disproves the tarot. I think it just shows how useful the tarot is. If the tarot taps into your subconscious knowledge and allows you to listen to that part of your inner self that you otherwise wouldn't listen to, you've just proven that tarot is very effective.
Yeah, I mean, what you're arguing about is the mechanism. Mm-hmm. You're not arguing about the effectiveness, which I often find that a lot of skeptics' complaints is about the mechanism. What they're complaining about is the style, right? It is a stylistic concern. It's like, well, sure, it's intuition, but look, it's hokey pokey witchy stuff. It's literally a complaint.
It's a stylistic critique.
It's a stylistic complaint. They might even accept that it is intuition and it is information you already had. It's a stylistic complaint. Right, because there's multiple ways you could describe that, but they're sort of, it's like saying to a healer, well, what you do is just placebo. Okay, what you do is just placebo, and yet the client is better. the client got better, and yet you're saying what I do is placebo, as if it's some sort of insult that the client got better. Same with I think that's what you're saying about the tarot. It's like, you're saying I got the right answer, or in this case, we're talking about stocks. Like, I literally got the right stock pick and I made money on it. But you're saying because I made money on it, it's just me accessing my own subconscious mind. So, you know, it's nothing. Okay. But I got the right money. I made the choice that made me a lot of money. So exactly what is your complaint here? Right.
If we're getting into more subjective points of view, I do think that there are different, you can operate the tarot and you can operate healing or energy healing in different modalities, right? So some levels of energy healing, some levels of using the tarot is the placebo effect, is just tapping into conscious, very psychological oriented. But I do believe that there are other ways you can tap into these tools and skill sets that's not just the subconscious and not just placebo. It really is tapping into something else. Without a universally agreed upon language system or vocabulary, sometimes we'll use the word spirits, we'll use the word channeling different types of, you know, divinities. And then we can talk about that. But I think that's more a matter of semantics sometimes. I think because we're so limited with our vocabulary, we just say, oh, that's a god, that's a goddess. And I'm not against that. It's just that we don't have better words at this time to communicate in a way that we both universally agree. So I do think there is a spirit element to tarot as well that isn't in holistic tarot, because I wasn't sure people would be ready for that primer. I wanted this book to be a primer text, but that is something I definitely integrate into my practice.
It's interesting because in my first book, Hands on Chaos Magic, I literally talk about the theory of models of magic, or models of how magic can work. Obviously, we talked about the psychological, and that's the intuition. Mm-hmm. We could talk about the spirit model of magic. The spirits are directly. You could talk about the energy. You could come up with other necessarily models to describe this, but it is a lot like what you're describing, I think, where everyone might have different metaphors of how the world actually makes this work. But in the end, it's sort of lacking because we have to try to segment it into it's this or this, but that it's probably all of the above at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, at least in Mandarin, the way I speak it, shen is the word for psyche, inner psyche, psychology is the same word we use to describe gods, goddesses, and spirits. And so I think if you look at language, it explains a lot about their cultural philosophy. And so because our language, we use the same word to describe inner psyche and psychology as we do the divine gods, goddesses, and spirits, it kind of shows the cultural philosophy that I bring to these types of works is that they are interwoven and they're interrelated. But I've learned also to try to keep it separate when I talk to people about it, because when you start mixing it, you start to confuse all sorts of people. So I try to keep it separate. But in my mind, it's one and the same.
I think that's a beautiful point, because in the West, we definitely have a word for mind, and we definitely have a word for spirit. But you don't in Chinese. And that's an interesting point right from the start. It's a point Zach, when he talks about Taoist magic, he's often trying to get across to people this idea that there may not be such a separation there. And you're pointing out the language difference, that the culture doesn't value the difference between those two things. So to talk about one or the other in the Chinese sense of the word is not really totally understanding the culture. Whereas I could see why you would avoid that here, why you'd have to get to know a person first before you drop that truth bomb on them, right? So in your book, you have tons of spreads too. I mean, tons and tons and tons of research spreads that you had across that you collected that work for different purposes. Maybe you could just tell us some of the favorite ones and how you set them up and how you might use each one.
I think when I was a professional tarot reader, my go-to, and even in college when I was reading for people, right now, if you ask me for a reading, what I do is the first operation. So that's basically how I do all readings, the first operation of the opening of the key. And then if we have time, if you want to deep dive into what happened during the first operation, then I'll get into the second, third, fourth, and fifth. But that's sort of the way I've come to really work with the tarot. And the reason the book needed to have many different spreads was to have many different options. I don't think anybody uses all of them all of the time or even needs to master all of them. It's more about having options so the beginner can try different ones, figure out which ones work for them, and then stick to that or tweak it. I think even I tweak the first operation. If you use one type of reading method over and over again, you begin to just naturally tweak it to fit your own modality. And so that's the one that I use. Before the first operation, I used to use the Celtic cross a lot, or I would mix the two. I'd do the Celtic cross and I would do the first operation. But I also think that's because it's a product of the generation that I learned the tarot. At the time, everybody was using the Celtic cross. Most people didn't even know there were other spreads. And I'm joking, but you know what I mean? Like it was like three card spread, Celtic cross and the horseshoe. And I don't think there were any other spreads that were really taught. And then now it's this totally different world where people make up their own spreads, and there's like spreads on Instagram and spreads for full moons. And it's just a very different way of learning the tarot compared to when I was coming up in that world.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of the spreads, you mentioned a Baguala spread. I went through the book. I heard about it. I went straight to that page as soon as we got the books physically. I was like, I want to look at this. So what was kind of like the experimentation and thought process around that? Because obviously that's not common to tarot, right? So
Fengshui was the, so I believe a lot in, I guess I use the word geomancy, but I know the word geomancy is used differently in Western occultism. But Fengshui, in terms of this idea that the compass, right, the directions and certain, I guess, acupunctural or pulse points or chi points in the world around you can connect to different parts of our world or have different influences in our world in a way that we've now categorized as, for example, this corner over here tends to influence love and relationships. This corner over here tends to influence your career ambitions. And so everything for me is based on the environment around me using sort of a geocentric or even a self-centered point of view, where what's around what you are, find north, south, east, and west, and then sort of superimpose that magic square, the Luoshu magic square. That's always superimposed over either the early heaven or later heaven, Bakwa, depending on what tradition you use. And so from there, like if you're into the tarot, it only makes sense to then put tarot on top of that and use it as a divination system to activate and see. It's kind of like taking the temperature, right? You're using the tarot as a barometer to take the temperature of your love life, take the temperature of, you know, your work and career matters, and use that to see and detect what the chi looks like. So the tarot image becomes a barometer or like a picture of what the chi looks like. And I kind of connect the two. It works for me. So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at that point, you're mapping the universe to be a Chinese mapping of Lo Shu or Bagua, but you're using the symbology of the tarot deck that you understand to be to do those checks.
Correct.
At that point. Exactly. So. Which then gets into the next thing, which I found interesting, was you actually break down the tarot from the personal development standard, but you put percentages to it when you were doing it from a development standard. So the one example, you said there was a case study and someone had like zero error cards, but they had like four fire cards and you did analysis around that. So tell us like more about that process and again that thinking, because that I found very striking from more like a business analysis standard, where it's like, oh, this is really nice, like there's percentages, right?
That's funny. I always thought more as astrology. So for example, you want it, when you look at a birth chart, you always see whether based on the placement of the planets and personal sensitive points in the chart, you think, oh, is this person fire dominant, water, air, or earth dominant? So actually that kind of comes back to the hermetic traditions that you find in tarot for better and for worse, where you do see the conflation of astrology and tarot. So that's actually where I got it from, not necessarily business. And so when there's a spread of cards or there's multiple cards, especially in something like the Celtic Cross, where I think like there was 10 cards, right? And so you can almost kind of do the math, as you say, right? Like how many cards correspond with fire? How many cards correspond with water, air, and earth? Fire, this person has, you know, fiery, stubborn, they're temperamental. They also tend to be career-driven. Water, more emotional, probably more spiritual, better aligned with clergy, that kind of thing. You know, air, people tend to be more controversial. They tend to be dramatic. They also airy, mind-focused. They're too focused inside their own thoughts. Earth is more practical, you know, the Capricorn energy, more pragmatic, business-oriented, really good, prudent. And so when you see the layout of cards, I kind of do that quick math because it's pretty easy. There's only four categories. And then you see which one they're dominant in and which one they're weaker in. And I integrate that into the way I interpret the reading. And I've just found after doing many, many different readings that it's accurate. It works when people use that. So it's one that I definitely use every time I do a reading.
Cool.
So it's interesting because one of the things that's after is getting read that it's like personally a person has to work on that element. I mean that's to me sounded like a direct quote from the Hermetic Keys.
Yeah.
Like, okay, now, but with the tarot context, how might a person actually work on developing an element to get stronger when that when they get a kind of reading from you that kind of tells them like, hey, you have a fire deficiency.
If somebody has a fire deficiency, so one thing, they're probably yin dominant. And then I fold in a lot of traditional Chinese medicines. So I'm just kind of telling you how I would do a reading, right? So I say, okay, they're probably yin dominant. And then before I say that out loud, you assess their, you know, you look at their aura, you get a sense of who they are, you kind of get a sense. And if you have their birth chart, you look at the birth chart as well. But most likely, that's probably, I can speculate, that's one of the issues. So if they're fire weak, then there's a lot of different things you can do and you take a holistic approach. One is, let's look at their diet. Like, well, just give me a sense of what you eat in 1 week. Let's just talk about your diet and see what they're eating. Are they eating a lot of yin dominant foods, which is further exacerbating the situation, right? Like, what are you eating? Can we introduce other foods that are more yang dominant into your life to kind of help with your circulation, to get you more of a more energy inside of you, so you're not so lethargic. And then things that I believe in are also gemstones. I work a lot with gemstones, crystal correspondences. So can we do something as simple as have carnelian and fire agate that you can put around your home office? Can you put a little piece, you know, in the first top drawer of your work office? That's going to help give you a little bit more energy and be a little bit more proactive, be more assertive in your work environment. If you're fire weak, that's probably one of the issues that you're dealing with, is that you're too passive when you're, you know, in career settings and you're not sort of asserting, advocating for yourself strong enough. So how can we get you to advocate for yourself strong enough from a metaphysical vantage point? And even if you don't believe in any of this, something as simple as I look into my drawer, I see fire agate. I remember that crazy tarot reader told me about my career and having to speak up for myself. Oh, I better go speak up for myself. And you speak up for yourself. Mm-hmm. It still works, right? And so that's another thing that I think, just as a little talisman, just as a reminder or a charm, like the lucky rabbit's foot, right? Just giving you the Dumbo's feather, giving you that extra confidence to or remembering what you need to do in that work setting. What else? There's the career. Also, I also use feng shui, right? So then the fire would be south. And so I'd say, okay, well, what's in your house? What is in the southern sector, south sector of your home? And is there something there that's weakening you as well? So can we look at the southern sector of your home and amplify the fire chi in your home surroundings, so that it's kind of like you're fortifying the surroundings of your personal space with more fire, and you're navigating the world with more fire chi in your environment. And that can kind of help as well. So I attack it from many different angles if somebody's fire deficient.
Right. By the way, if people would like to, I was going to say, by the way, all the stones that Benvo mentioned, we carry. Okay. See, so there we go.
We also do feng shui consults too, both Andrea and I. So, so it definitely sounds like you have a big influence, at least, like, you know, I'm hearing Chinese medicine, I'm hearing feng shui. I mean, yeah, that's my bread and butter there. So this is where, in reference to the tarot, are you taking more, like, I know you mentioned diagnostic pieces. Are you using the tarot in any other ways, like, in terms of representing things, like you might have a tarot card in your drawer, for example, or you're doing it like methods like that?
A lot of people do use it that way. And I think it's effective. For me personally, I don't, because I use food talismans. And I mean, I just have, everyone has different tools, right? And I think somebody else would be like, food, I wouldn't use that. So it's, what do you use for yourself? So if I have a foo, why would I use a tarot card? Right. And so that's the reason I think it's effective. I think you could make the argument it's the same or very similar in concept. And so I think it's a totally legit way to use the tarot. It's just that I have a different tool for that. So I wouldn't use the tarot.
Let's see. So in terms of the arcana there, right, like walk us through the process in terms of, You broke down the minor, you broke down the majors. How could you use that as example for, again, just self-development, meditation, things like this?
So I think the very traditional textbook old way of looking at it was major arcana refer to forms of higher self-development, it's spiritual energies, it relates to extenuating circumstances, and then the minor arcana relate to everyday mundane happenings. And I think that's sort of the really traditional way of looking at it. We don't really look at it that way anymore. We kind of see it as intermixed, right? And so people don't have that very separated divide in terms of how they interpret major versus minor arcana. But in terms of how I look at it, even though we say all 78 cards are archetypes or archetypal energies, sure, I think the 22 of the majors, they work really, really well as a cohesive, complete set of 22 archetypes. And so I will use that specifically in terms of needing to activate a certain part of myself. So sometimes, you know, I'm not really the high priestess, but I want to be, right? Or I'm not, you know, I have creativity, but I have a writing block. And so how do I access that? I'm probably weaker on the Empress energy. So how do I use certain archetypes in the 22 majors to activate a particular facet of the inner self so I can get something done? So that's what I would use the 22 majors for. I don't necessarily use the minors for that. I think you can. I think you can do whatever you want. It's just that for the minor arcana, I see it more as a very strict four categories: fire, water, air, and earth. You know, the wands, cups, swords, and pentacles, coins, discs, what have you. And I see it more as representing the spectrum of fire energies, the spectrum of water energies and air energies, et cetera. And then different facets of that particular element that I want to activate. So that's how I, that's the way I view the two, but not everyone views it that way. And I don't think everyone has to view it that way.
So one of the funny stories you gave us was about using the first key of the Golden Dawn, the six keys of the Golden Dawn. And a huge party while drunk, and how that affected the readings. And maybe you could tell us the story.
Which story is it? The one that I just told you earlier about the open
right, right before the show.
Yeah, the Golden Dawn.
I was like, I don't think that's in the book, Andre. I'm pretty sure that was not in the book.
That's not in the book. It's not. It's definitely not.
So for me, I don't think I need to take it that seriously in terms of, I know there's, from when I was learning the tarot, there is this strong ethical principle of you shouldn't be doing tarot readings when you're incapacitated. And so some people do feel that way very strongly. I don't. I think if I'm going to do a professional paid tarot reading, of course, I'm not going to be incapacitated. But if I'm doing readings among friends, I think there's nothing cooler in the world than to do tarot readings when you're drunk off your ass. Because like you're unfiltered, the coolest messages come through. Like sometimes it's not even you. You like go into an altered state of consciousness. You start channeling spirits that you would otherwise block mentally because you're like, no, I don't want to go there. If you're drunk, you'll go there, right? So, you know, these things are so much fun. And that was something that I did, which was, you know, try to go through the opening of the key, go through all as far as you can go in the five operations, completely plastered. And I thought that was a lot of fun. I felt like people started talking about, like people started like, you know, like channeling, right? Yeah, channeling where they're speaking in tongues. My friends who never normally would do that, but are tarot readers. And I just think it's something that is worth trying if, you know, it's within the, you know, if it's within your lifestyle to do that comfortably and safely, then I think it's totally fun.
We're okay with that.
We're totally okay with that.
Especially given, I'm initiated voodoo priest. I know about that kind of stuff, right? I'm okay with it. And actually, that gets to a lot of some of the questions that actually came up that I'm seeing. It's kind of like, isn't the diviner a big part of any readings? Like, and this kind of, that story leads into that question. What does the actual diviner, how do they affect the readings?
I have so many thoughts on this. Where do I start? So I think the tarot itself, the literal physical like deck of cards, right? Especially if you're working with a set system like the Rider-Waite-Smith or the Thoth, the history of it, the sort of consensual, the universal use of it, everybody having this consensus of what this card means, that card means, and how we're reading it, this energy that's been built up over centuries, I think does infuse that particular pack of cards with some particular level of power. And so a total, like my 9-year-old niece can pick up a tarot deck, pull a card, and there's something happens there. And I truly believe that, right? Because the cards inherently, because of what it has gone through, has accumulated a certain level of power. Now, can that power actually be productive? You know, she can pull a card. There's some power there, but can she read it? Well, where can you go from there? And so that's where the power of the diviner comes in. And even there, I think you can use psychic ability, which is the ability to tap into something that transcends time, space in the linear form that we understand it. Or it can be something as simple as you have some really strong skill sets when it comes to reading people, like a form of cold reading. And maybe you don't call it cold reading, and maybe it has no negative intentions whatsoever, but it's just something that you're really good at and you're tapping into that. And that's one mode of reading that some readers use. Others is the psychic ability. And then others, I think, are really good as a priest or priestess where they're channeling something. They're able to draw in some pillar of pre-existing force out there that has foreknowledge, and they're tapping into that. And the messages coming through isn't the voice of the human being that you're seeing in front of you, but something beyond. So there's different ways of using the tarot. So to answer your question, yeah, absolutely. It's the ability of the diviner doing the tarot reading. But it's in combination with the fact that this tool innately in and of itself, due to its history and its use, has also accumulated its own innate power.
But some people, even with the Rider White, just don't use the precursor readings at all. They're just intuitive what the answer is. Or they kind of ignore the history of it.
Mm-hmm. And there's the psychic, and they're kind of using psychic intuition. So you see that on TikTok a lot, right, where they're pulling cards and just saying what comes to their mind. I don't think that's, I would never discredit that. I think that's just a different form of reading. The way they're reading cards is psychic ability.
So what about the state of mind of them too? Like, so you're getting into like what their ability level is, but from your experience, how about the state of mind? How does that affect, you know, possible outcomes of the reading too? So we have ability level, which certainly you're describing some people as being basically mediumship, and some people having innate psychic ability, and some people are just kind of actually have enough of the history to actually read based on that, or they're not necessarily, they might say they're code reading, even though they're getting intuitions. So that's kind of like what type they're doing. But then even how, what does it matter? Like, because so parts of your book are also bringing up the points of meditation and why it's important. So like, so what is actually even the state of mind of the reader going in? How can that affect the outcome of reading too?
I think it affects everything. I think state of mind goes to how biased you are when you're reading. Are you just reading for yourself? Are you projecting? Or are you truly, truly being objective and empathic, and you're really tapping into the interests of the other person? Are you being objective? Are you imposing your own prejudices or your own moral values onto the other party? And I think that gets into really dangerous territory. And if you're the type, if I dare be so bold, to impose moral values onto somebody else during a reading, you probably shouldn't be doing tarot readings for people. I just think that that's very dangerous, and you're going to lead people astray very quickly. And so state of mind is extremely important. And for me, meditation is just one of those really easy, not that meditation is easy, but it's easy to recommend. It's an easy way to integrate a practice into your life that not immediately, but like gives you measurable and observable results in real time, and in a way that you can immediately see that, oh, you're adjusting the way you're viewing the world. You're adjusting how, I don't want to say selfless, but how much more of other people's perspectives you're able to see simultaneously with yours. One of the great things about meditation is that it opens your mind to that, as Jung would say, the collective unconscious, you know, Freudian, Jungian theory. But it's this collective unconscious, you're tapping into something that's like a network. And we are constantly aligning your own personal state of mind with that collective network. It's just much easier to be empathic and not see everything from a very closed-minded, your own biased point of view. And so the state of mind of a tarot reader is not only important, but if it's not correct, like if it's not in the right state where they're being objective and empathic and compassionate, it's dangerous.
So how would you know that, because you're describing meditation in relation to that, but how do you personally know you're in the right state, the non-judgmental state, to actually be able to make it happen? And to be, even if someone maybe doesn't share your moral views, or maybe, you know, maybe they have different, completely different views of you, how do you personally know you're in the right place to be able to start with that?
For me, since we're talking about the tarot, the way my recommendation is to study the tarot. That's why studying the tarot is important if we're talking about tarot readings. So, for example, what we were just touching on earlier, the psychic reader with the tarot, I think it's much easier to be biased and inject your moral point of view if you're using tarot in a psychic way, where I pull, I don't know, the Five of Pentacles, I'm like, oh, this is a happy card, right? Like, it's much easier to get biased if you're not using an established system. So if you use an agreed upon established system of correspondences and meanings to the 78 cards, then you can kind of tap into that and use that to almost do a self-check, right? You use what cards come up in the tarot reading to self-check whether or not you're imposing moral views or you're literally reading what the card says based on a more textbook-ish correspondence. So that's why knowledge of the tarot is so important, because it's that checks and balances to keep your own moral values and judgments at bay.
Right. So this is where it's know your system is what you're saying, right? I mean, this is like talking about, like, you know, extensively in the book, you go through the different card sets where, you know, you cover them in an upright manner and in a reverse manner. And you gave both correspondences on that.
And know thyself too. Know thyself is very important. So for example, I'll be really personal, right? So for example, if people come to me for readings on childbirth or having children or pregnancy, because that's a personal sore spot, I will say immediately, I'm not the best person to do that reading. I can't trust myself to be unbiased when I do this reading. Right, you have to find somebody who can be unbiased. If you're doing a career reading, I feel fairly confident with myself. I can be very objective, you know? So just, you have to know yourself too. So if you know your own shadows and you know your own weaknesses and where cycle up, what your own inner triggers, then you should probably kind of check yourself out and say, there's a conflict of interest here. I can't trust myself to be objective. So I can't do that type of a reading for you.
So do you have any things coming up soon that you want to advertise?
Soon? I don't know about how soon, soon-ish. So I recently finished translating, well, I didn't recently finish. It was a long time ago, but I finished writing the whole book for it on the I Ching. And so that's coming out July-ish of 2023. And it's a book on the cultural lore, the history, the mythology of the I Ching, but it's also the 64 hexagrams translated. And in the translations, there's annotations to the actual cultural references that I haven't really seen in English yet, where you actually get the references to history and culture that and things that happened during the Zhou and Shang dynasties that you don't see. So you have that context for why they're talking about what they're talking about. So that's going to come out in July of 2023.
Nice.
All right. Well, we're gonna have
we'll
to bring
definitely
you
have you back for that,
because it sounds like that's the end of the rebellion right there. To go full circle, like we're done with the Taoist Buddhist rebellion at that point. Comes full circle. Do you have any upcoming events or speech, classes that you're teaching or workshops that you might be doing that people could be interested in attending?
October, there's the Northwest Tarot Symposium in Portland, Oregon. I'll be a keynote speaker there. Matt Oren is another keynote speaker. So that's going to be really exciting. There's going to be a lot of really interesting people. If you want to connect with the tarot community in person, I strongly recommend going to Northwest Tarot Symposium.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, Zaccaroni, we have a few things coming up, don't we?
That we do. Well, one, you got the workshop coming up on air next weekend. So we got that for our 10 sponsors. And then 10 sponsors also get to see our co-op on Sundays when we're building stuff and creating things. You also get 3 years worth of content of all the virtual recordings there from basically anything you can think of. You name it, we probably have it there. We just finished up our chakra series. And then we have... what's first? Let me think. Hamilton Pagan Pride and Toronto Pagan Pride, where we're both running workshops and we'll be vending. So
you can stop by our booth and see us the whole day, although we're going to wear masks, so don't get offended.
Yes, and as a privy, just if people are wondering what we're going to be running, in Hamilton, Andrea will be running a candle magic workshop. I'll be talking about the Taoist organ exercises and meditations. In Toronto, I'll be covering fox magic. Andrea will be covering what is chaos magic. So we have a full panel for y'all there. Plus, we also have meet and greet, right, with Equinox, who is part of the store.
You forgot the other thing that, deep down the rabbit hole, we'll be broadcasting live at 10 o'clock in the morning, which I know is a little rougher.
10:45, going to be a coffee day on that one. Going to be a coffee day.
10:45 with a panel of many of the presenters from Hamilton Pagan Pride. We will be presenting live as a panel discussion like we've done so many other times before. from the event, if we could get enough bandwidth. Yes. Which will be out in the park, so we'll see how good our 5G cellular is right then and there when we're broadcasting. But we will have camera recordings too if we have to actually go there.
So that is, I think, in the next coming few weeks. I think that pretty much covers it. Next week, we do have, let me pull up the schedule here, actually. I think it's, let's see. So next week, we have the Powwow Grimoire coming up with Rob Phoenix. So that's going to be a fun conversation because that's not a topic that's talked about much.
Powwow, if you're used to Ohio and Pennsylvania, powwow is all the signs and paintings on all the barns. It's actually a magical system from German Dutch that we're going to hit. Now, if you come here physically, we have this in our library. Thanks.
We do. Thank you.
So if you want to check this out, like before to buy, come to our library. Our library is free at Queen City. You can come in, sit down, check it out, read it, and then, you know, kind of preview it before you even buy it, to make sure that we're not fooling you about how awesome this book actually is.
It's awesome.
That way you can actually see it in person and kind of peruse it and then make the decision. I think you'll agree to buy this particular book.
Absolutely.
Which is reversed on my screen, so. Thanks for coming on the show, Venable.
Thank you.
Hope to get you back on in when you get that I Ching book. Mm-hmm. Coming full circle, having rejected it, I'd be very interested in seeing.
We'd definitely be interested.
About the I Ching.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
If you could hang on just for a second, I'll take us on out. Or actually, Zach will.
I will.
He's got control today.
So stay healthy, stay safe, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole is sponsored by the Queen City Curio and Apothecary in Toronto, Ontario, proudly in East Chinatown. Our store is at 607 Girard Street East, Unit 401. Just take the elevator up to the fourth floor and we're right there. We carry the finest spiritual goods for all spiritual paths. Whatever you are into, we can help. Check out our full public library of occult materials with over 1,000 books. Accessible anytime the store is open. Check us out online at queencitycurio.ca. Be sure to leave a wish at our wish shrine right outside our door. You never know, it may just come to pass.